Hello, welcome to recording number 13 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. This is the 20th anniversary of the Cannon Fire website. All right, we're going to start restart here on page 95. A slight recap, it is the section where Gord and the Renee, Gord is on the Renee barge, and they are fighting a sea monster risen out of the near Dev. This is page 95, last paragraph. Gord was appalled to note that the thing was now close enough for him to clearly see the shafts protruding from its head and neck. It was a blackish green in color, with large fishy eyes. Its snake-like body was propelled by lashing tail and huge fins. The monster's neck was at least 20 feet long, and its head was like a cross between a snake's and a crocodile's. How could so many teeth fit into one mouth? Gord wondered, and how could they be so large? The monster was at least 100 feet long. Instinctively, he drew his long dagger and hefted it. If he was going to be dinner for that thing, at least he'd give the bastard something to remember him by. Another missile from the scorpion struck the great serpent full in its open mouth. It roared again, snapped its jaws shut, and spit out bits of splintered shaft. Yellowish blood oozed from its mouth. Too, this missile had done some damage. More quarrels struck it, and several javelins, too, but the serpent's advance was not slowed. The captain was doing his best to manage one more shot from the scorpion before the monster fell upon the barge and destroyed it. Women were screaming somewhere behind Gord, and children were wailing at the top of their lungs. What was going to happen next was obvious to all. The monster was no more than 20 yards distant when Miklos got his last missile ready and aimed. He released it without hesitation, almost if he wasn't bothering to aim. The bolt struck the creature's eye directly in the center of the huge green pupil. The resulting bellow of pain from the monster drowned out all other sounds, and its rush for the barge took on new energy. As it came so close that its reeking breath and slimy stench nearly overwhelmed Gord, he hurled his dagger with every ounce of strength he had, aiming for the serpent's remaining eye. A virtual cloud of quarrels, javelins, and other missiles accompanied the dagger, for this was the last moment before doomsday. As if in slow motion, Gord saw his weapon turning lazily in the air, pommel under, blade over, slowly revolving to present the slender point to the onrushing eye. Shafts of quarrels and javelins protruded as pins from a cushion, for at this range it was difficult to miss, and the scales were less effective protection. Then the dagger met its target. At the same moment the monster's neck lashed forward, and its great jaws snapped. Hapless Renee was cut in half by the saw-edged teeth, and blood spattered everywhere. What happened next, Gord wasn't sure of. The serpent collided with the barge, and the force of the impact hurled him from his feet. Gord's head struck something, and the next thing he knew, he was being ministered to by a fat woman whose breath reeked of garlic. When he asked what was happening, she said only that they were in a safe harbor, and he should rest. Gord had no choice in the matter, for he abruptly passed back into unconsciousness. Break. All right, well, we've got some more description of the creature. It's referred to as a sea monster, and whether that is a generic term or a term for almost any large creature appearing out of the waters of the near Deb, it does not seem to be a specific name for the monster. And it could simply be that, like most creatures are probably not seen as, if they're of the same type, they're probably not seen by specific names. It might be hard for some people to, recognize goblin from kobold. But even within the type of general term for a creature, there might be variations that you see in the game where the common person wouldn't be able to tell you the difference between one or the other of these general types, even though they may have some very different traits. Now, we get to see a little bit of combat described, and obviously this is supposed to be a very powerful monster, as it's taking quite a lot of damage. And finally, we're shown Gord's, great skill again in his toss of the dagger that pierces the other eye of the sea monster. Although this was it's a combat description, so we get little things like yellowish blood, some description, physical description of the sea monster. But really, there isn't a great deal more, especially when you're describing action, except to see how you can convert what would be plain dice rolling in the game for the DM to come up with a more descriptive, of how damage works. And even in the end there, where Gord is obviously injured, he's obvious loss, a consciousness and probably hit points. But you don't have to describe that in a way that is like, arrow by arrow, tooth by tooth kind of damage. Damage in the game reflects a wide variety of things that are happening. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 97, paragraph 2. A few days later, Gord was up and around, feeling fine. Geno told him all about the conclusion of the matter. Blinded, the sea serpent could do little but thrash about erratically in its efforts to destroy its victims. The initial impact had badly damaged the stern of the barge, but it had also sent the vessel shooting away, even as the shock of its wounds had caused the monster to recoil. Two of the Renee had been killed by the collision, one crushed to death by the serpent's massive body, the other overboard and drowned, probably, in addition to the unfortunate who was caught in the monster's jaws. Everyone not holding fast to something and braced had been thrown flat by the force of the creature hitting the vessel, but in a moment most of the crew were back on their feet and shooting again. Was the serpent mortally wounded by them? They would never know, for its writhing and splashing on the surface had attracted something else. Yano had seen something huge and dark rise beneath the sea serpent, and then the wounded monster had suddenly been jerked beneath the ochre-stained waves, gone without a trace. Break. And as described as part of the description in the previous paragraphs, the sea monster is 100 feet long. And obviously here is another monster that is big enough to attack and kill even a badly wounded 100-foot-long monster, but something that is seen by the Rene Yano as huge and dark, and pulling the huge sea serpent below the waves. We have the basic description that the Rene are obviously not necessarily particularly high level, that these seem to be commoners or very low level Rene who are killed 1, 2, 3, one bite of the creature, one crushed, one drowned overboard. We're seeing here that the Rene are probably not all going to be considered greatly experienced, but they themselves are simply more than likely, like most people in the setting, common people, unleveled, who only have maybe some special skills with certain items, a little special skill in perhaps thievery or Perhaps also a little maybe combat expertise with a knife, or like the captain shows, and the others, that they're throwing javelins and using crossbows. Also the captain, who seems to be quite experienced, is firing he's firing that scorpion, which is like a siege weapon, a giant crossbow, firing lance-long missiles, and he is able to strike it. I think every single time he either wounds it, once in the mouth, once in the neck, or it comes off of the sea monster's armored flesh, the scaly flesh.
I'm thinking something like those siege weapons they use to shoot at the dragons in Game of Thrones.
Yes, exactly. Which in Game of Thrones were a little ridiculous, right. But...
It might not have been that dramatic, but it's something like that.
Yes, and, I would say here it makes a point that the weapon takes skill to use, I think. I don't think it would be quite as big as that Game of Thrones ones, but they are describing that the bolts are several feet long, that they're as long as a lance.
Definitely so, something that was designed with that purpose, to pierce like scales, like dragons or monsters.
Yes, definitely something that they would meant more for damaging a sea monster. I actually thought that we'd get some description of the oil being used against it. Maybe the flames finally driving it off when it was close, but there's no mention of that. Because they were prepared. They had this two scorpions, one at front, one at back. They had crossbows ready. They hadn't mentioned the javelins, but they had mentioned that they had oil and ready to be thrown over at the creatures and set on fire. So I was a little surprised that wasn't one of the tactics mentioned to be used effectively against the monster. And here it ends up that, in a sense, they're probably lucky that the smaller monster, or that they wounded one monster so that it's eaten by another.
Right.
All right.
I might have missed it. Did they mention how far offshore they were?
Oh, they did. They simply mentioned previously that the storm had driven them into the near Dev, into the deep water. That they had been pushed away from shore, but no distances were mentioned previously. And here we see that Gord is again, he's knocked unconscious. He has to have the fight explained to him, but he doesn't know the distance that they traveled, but they're now back at port, at shore, and at safety.
Yeah, because I've looked at the maps, and you can see near the shoreline, looks like it's shallow water, and then there's a deeper blue in the center. Yes, so it's definitely someplace they didn't want to go.
Yeah, and the colored map, the barges are definitely, they're river barges, and they're coast huggers. And probably not coast huggers for more open sea, but you don't know. But as being called river barges, I would assume that they wouldn't normally be even crossing the outer coast of areas. They might be, but I believe that the water would be, worse even on, like the outer coast, rather than being shore hugging things. There's, I think, a big difference between what they're able to do with the river barge, and then the depth of the near Dev is really not what they're designed for, but they're prepared for it. And these weapons don't seem to be particularly anti-pirate, anti-ship weapons.
Right. Yeah, would you use the hooks and, not really the oil, but I mean, maybe, who knows?
You would think that if they had anti-ship, what they'd be thinking of is something that would shoot burning oil over onto the other ship.
Right.
To fend off other ships. The crossbows, javelins are fine. They're a little slow, but they don't require, I don't believe they require, the same skill to use as a short or a longbow might require. You might get more accuracy from a lower level character or even someone that who's just, say, like a common sailor, but with some kind of benefit to their ability to use a common weapon.
Okay, thanks.
All right, and I'm going to restart right here. We are on page 97, paragraph 4. Everybody aboard was happy that whatever could take it so easily was satisfied with that meal. They'd patched the stern sufficiently to allow them to make for shore in safety and Cavern Cliff Cove, one of the secret places the barge folk wintered in. A small bay was on the eastern tip of the land that surrounded near Div's mid-bay. The vessel had made port without further trouble and had been there for a week. Break. I break right here because here we have mention of, you know, their specific secret area here, Cavern Cliff Cove. We know that it's near Div's mid-bay, and it's one of the projects I was working on last year was to develop a Rene adventure and setting area in this Cavern Cliff Cove. So I don't believe it's really mentioned much of anywhere else, but we do have a little information here on how the barge folk, that they not only winter at the cities in small groups, like they did in the city of Greyhawk with their barges tied together, but they also have secret places. And that also says to me that they are obviously the main traffic that is doing the rivers and they're going up and down the coastlines of the near Dev. There might be other ones or bigger ships, but at this size of their small barges, it sounds like they are perhaps the predominant group. If they're able to maintain secret wintering places, that really speaks to me that they know the area. They're not worried about other people coming in, and as had been mentioned, the women of the Rene are they're able to do several different kinds of magic, kind of magic user cleric with as mentioned, is witches and kind of like a high priestess and a soothsayer. So maybe they're able to help disguise their secret places from casual observers. Or maybe it's simply good camouflage. We're rife with descriptions of camouflage and disguise.
Yeah, that would fit right in.
Yeah, it fits in with this general theme. We're being presented with the outlook from the Beggar Thief and the Thieves Guild. So that is one of the very interesting things about the Saga of Old City and Gord, is that we're being given an eye view into what the outlook of the thieves and the Rene, who are also kind of known as, horse traders or, little thievery mixed with them as well. And the old Beggars Union, Thieves Guild. So we're given a lot of information from the eye view of a thief rather than the beginning of a story with a cleric or a magic user or a fighter that we might normally see. That is one of the invaluable things about Saga of Old City. Not only shows you something of the city itself, but it shows you from the perspective of the lower class and the thieves within the city, and that's not always what you find in fantasy stories. I'm going to restart right here. We are on page 97, and this is paragraph 5. It astonished Gord to learn that he'd been unconscious for so long, but he wasn't worried. His head was sore where it had been gashed, and he knew that his scalp would always bear the scar of the encounter. He did feel pride in having been part of the fight against the monster, and that his own skill with a dagger had been vital to the survival of the whole Rene family aboard the barge. Because of that skill, Gord now had a place of honor in the group. Everyone, Gord included, seemed to have forgotten about his gawking and his hesitation during the early stages of the battle, and the Bargers enthusiastically acknowledged him as an adopted member of the Rene tribe. There were only 5 other barges at the place, for with the advent of warm weather, most of the barge folk had set forth on their travels. Those 5, however, joined in the celebration Miklos held. Break. Well, I know that you were asking about the weather, the time of year, and so here we're given that it is the end of winter. And since this happened, Gord left really only a week or so before. So that storm is an end of winter storm that hit them. So that can be used as part of the setting ideas. Is it was an unknown storm out of the usual? It doesn't seem to be in context. It seems to be that they just take their chances with the weather, and perhaps it's a little unusual, but nothing that anybody commented on.
Yeah, I was wondering if maybe the lake were particularly stormy in one season of the year as opposed to another.
Yes, and we don't see this as being said. This was an unusual, it was a powerful storm, mm-hmm. but we're not being told that it was something out of place or unusual, and we're finally given in this paragraph that it is at the end of winter, where the advent of warm weather. So where it's either a warm end of winter, or we're at the beginning of spring, and this is just the winter where they normally would come and hole up during the winter. There's still 5 barges in this secret cove, so how many Rene gather there during the winter is obviously much greater than that.
Yeah, the storms must be common enough because all the barges are equipped with the scorpions.
Yes. Well, I assume they are. Now, this is also one of the larger barges. It's not that big, but they mentioned that the smaller ones only have 1 mast, and that this was a 2-masted barge. They actually give the dimensions, which have it as a fairly... For a barge, I would say it seems to be a fairly narrow barge, perhaps, I don't know, I'll have to look into that again, because it seemed to me to be extraordinarily narrow for a barge, and more like, even narrow for what would be like, say, a northern longship. It seemed to pretty narrow to hold that many people. Because it held, I believe, 2 dozen Rene. Now, you also notice there's nothing that is really being made of comments so far about their casualties, which would be 3 males out of their family group. That seems a pretty harsh number of casualties. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 98, paragraph 2. At his first opportunity, Gord asked the lord of the barge for more information about the creature that had come so near to finishing them all. "What do you call those things anyway?" he inquired. "Big bastards," Miklos replied. "No, I mean, what is its actual name?" "Shit, I've never seen anything like it before," Miklos responded. "Nor as big as that either." Gord didn't feel quite so cocky after that short exchange. He realized fully that a lot of good luck had assisted them, and their missiles had been only part of it. Anyway, he was still alive to tell about it, and that was the important thing. That he dismissed the whole affair and concentrated on the celebration. Break. Well, that's pretty informative there, that the sea monster, Miklos had never seen anything that big. Or quite like it before, or anything like it before.
Now, you think he's talking about the first or the second one?
I think it's both, because Gord is asking, what do you call those things? You know, plural, and then big bastards, plural.
I chuckled at that.
Yeah, so, it's also says, like we were talking, that they're prepared for it, but normally... they would not have a reason to venture out in the middle of the near Dev, and that the barges are definitely river and coast huggers. So getting pushed out to the deeper waters is obviously not unexpected because they're set up for it, but maybe not quite as far out as they went, having these gigantic sea monsters that are ready to attack them.
Yeah, now, it happened fairly quickly. So, I mean, imagine if you went further out.
Yeah, and I mean, they had said that they were prepared for after a storm, when they were getting everything ready with the scorpions and the crossbows, that they were prepared for something to come up, attack them. But this was a 100-foot-long sea monster and something else that was as big or bigger that ate it. So, you know, we don't know if it was a bigger version or a same version as the other sea serpent. And I like the fact that Gygax has it that you do not, that the people aren't necessarily going to be tell you, oh, well, that's a hobgoblin, or that's a, you know, that's a mimic or a wolfling or whatever, that, or an ettercap, or that the common people may have no names or previous surviving encounter with something like this. So, you know, it's I think the idea is that you're going to have this shock from most common people. You might have areas in the wild where there are experienced hunters and experienced warriors, but I think that somebody whose main life, like the Renee, is going from town and city and carrying goods, that they're not going to have the experience of someone living on the wild, even though the wild may simply be a little further out to sea, out to the near, into the lake of the near Div. But it's something they would not be normally doing, and only were stuck there because of the storm. All right. I am going to restart here. We are on page 98, and this is paragraph 7. Gord didn't feel quite so cocky after that short exchange. Oh, I'm sorry. We're starting on paragraph 8. I kind of jumped back there a bit. Paragraph 8, page 98. There was all sorts of food and drink, singing, music, and dancing. Gord scrutinized all of the younger women, thinking that chance might have it that Adaz, the girl he'd met and liked as a boy when he first stayed with Renee, would be among the folk from the other barges. There were several strikingly pretty girls in the crowd, and all returned his scrutiny with bold looks. This in turn brought him black looks from any number of the men there, and when he noticed this, Gord quickly quit his flirting. Fight would not be the way to end a feast, celebrating victory over a sea monster and his adoption into the barge folk tribe. And even though he now kept his eyes elsewhere and conversed only with the men around him, the damage had been done. As Gord was lifting his goblet to drink more of the harsh red rind, the wine the Rene favored, it was struck from his hand. On your feet, dog. Now that you're one of us, I can challenge you to the test of the blades. A tallish, muscular fellow stood before him, legs spread in an aggressive posture. Piss off, countered Gord. Why should I want to fight you? Are you a coward? The Rene replied, shouting. All saw the way you looked at Estrella, the way she returned your lustful gaze. She's my woman. Honor demands that I fight you for her, now. Just as he was about to suggest that the fellow bugger his honor and go pick a fight with his woman, Miklos stood up and shouted back at the challenger. Are you calling the family of Miklos curs? Are you saying that we have no pride? Pig! He bent down, grabbed Gord by his blouse, pulled him upright. He will fight and he will teach you manners. Crap, said Gord under his breath. What was that? Demanded Miklos. I said that man is a craphead and a stinking yellow mongrel who cannot beat even a large child in a fair fight, Gord hastily replied. Good. "Teach him a lesson," shouted the captain. Even as Gord's opponent was reaching grimly for the dagger on his wide belt, Gord could feel the celebrants in the immediate area moving back to make an arena for the impending fight. Too bad for Gord that he had only his small sheath knife. The great dagger he had thrown into the sea serpent's orb was somewhere in the waters of the lake, or more probably lodged in the intestines of some leviathan. According to the test of blades, which he had heard about from his bargemates, Gord must face his opponent with whatever weapon he had. At least its point was sharp and its edge keen. "Careful, brother," hissed Miklos, speaking nearly in Gord's ear so that the others nearby could not hear. "Zoltan is young, but he is one of the best daggermen in the whole tribe." Gord heaved a long sigh. "Thank you, my lord," he replied sarcastically out of the corner of his mouth. The remark was lost on Miklos, for he had turned away and was already busy with the active betting going on. Break. All right, well, we're given here glimpse into the culture of the Renee. It's a little bit different from what was described previously when Gord had been staying with them in the city of Greyhawk, but he was not an adopted member of the tribe at that point.
He was a guest then.
Yes, and as Zoltan points out, he is now a member and he can be challenged. So as a guest, they wouldn't have challenged him. Who knows what they would have allowed him to do there, but as a member of Miklos's tribe and family, he can be challenged. They have their sense of honor and the style of the dagger fights. As Gord has been told that the test of the dagger, that is something that Zoltan refers to, and Gord has already been made aware of as a particular fighting ritual. So we can take that as part of the general Rene culture, and also this idea that they commonly would have these, inter-family, inter-tribal fights and arguments going down that are faced with the blade. It doesn't say whether they can be to the death or first blood or such right here, but it seems fairly deadly. Or of course, the insults and are going back and forth, and it seems to be the general idea that that is the Rene culture, to insult each other.
I know something about the language. It seems Gord reverted back to that 1940s gangster kind of.
Yes, that the captain.
That might be the way people speak in the slums.
It might be, but you notice it's also pretty much how the Rene Lord speaks.
Yeah, he did speak that way when he was talking about the monsters.
Yes, and it seems to be more like somebody from the docks of a 19th, early 20th century than you'd kind of expect in the fantasy campaign.
Right.
It's not terrible, but it does seem a little bit out of place in the fantasy novel. We notice that Gord, Gord again seems to get in trouble over women. This is the third woman who he is now getting in trouble over. First there was Violet, and then there was Trelane, and now it's this Estrella. There was also that Adaz who was mentioned.
Yeah, I had almost forgotten about her.
Yes, and he was hoping to see her again. Now, the difference that had been that Gord as a stranger, the women, the young women would not eye them boldly. It's only here with Gord as an adopted member of the Rene that the women, not even just Estrella, that the women are looking boldly back at Gord. So you can see here is a difference in the culture of the Rene, that as they appear to people not of their culture is much different than how they are to people within their culture. The names are, of course, you know, they're typical, you know, kind of European. Zoltan is a Hungarian Magyar name. Miklos is more of a Slavic Russian kind of name. Estrella might even be more of like an Italian kind of name. You know, it just means star. I think it's just like a Latinized or an Italian version of star, Estrella. So, you know, he's most of this seems to be the kind of gypsy that makes up movies like The Wolfman, you know, where they have the gypsy tribe that reads the fortune of Lon Chaney Jr. and he has the pentagram on his hand. And that's where you get the idea of perhaps how Gygax saw the René as more characteristic of light entertainment than trying to really find out anything about the real Romani culture that varied, you know, because it was European, it was Eastern European, and it was English and Irish even, that the, you know, the gypsy cultures, and they varied, that they were all over, you know, Europe, from the far west in Ireland and England over to Eastern Europe. And so this seems to be more of a moving or popular entertainment version of the René. All right. I'm going to restart. We're on page 99, the last paragraph. Someone came out of the crowd with a leather thong and tied it to the left wrists of the combatants so that they were separated by about a yard when the cord was stretched taut. In the instant after this man stepped back, Zoltan swept his dagger through the space between them. The cord reacted well, but not quickly enough to prevent Zoltan's blade from tracing... Pardon me, this is a page turn for me. And it's a little difficult for me to get these pages turned. One of the reasons I like that electronic Kindle so much, the larger font and the not having to turn paper pages. I'm sorry, these are really stuck together today. All right. Zoltan's blade from tracing a stinging path across the front of his blouse, breaking the skin beneath, but doing him no great harm. So, thought Gord, this is how we begin. As he circled his opponent warily, Gord could just barely distinguish the voices shouting out the odds. In the space of a few seconds following Zoltan's opening swipe, they had risen from 7-2, all the way to 10-1 in Zoltan's favor. Even though concentrating hard on the matter at hand, Gord could not help but feel indignant at that. Hell, one little slash across his belly didn't mean he'd lost the duel. The rules of the ritual dictated that if either combatant cut the tie that held them together, then the person was considered the loser, and must either pay the winner a dozen silver nobles or be outcast. Gord actually considered slashing the thong and ending the contents. But for what did a few coins mean? But the backing of his new family kept him at it. Gord assumed that they had wagered everything they owned on him, judging from their shouts of encouragement and their catcalls about Zoltan's ability. He had to go on. Even though it looked bad, Miklos expected him to prove himself worthy. The years of schooling he had undergone would now be put to a real test. These conditions were almost the same as those prescribed in practice matches with less lethal weapons, but he wished they were using swords rather than shorter blades. Gord was a better swordsman than knife fighter, though not by much. Slash and stab, parry and thrust. The match went on for minutes, but it seemed to last hours. Both contestants were sweating from strain and exertion, but Gord marveled to himself that the tension was not actually affecting him, and that he was still feeling fresh and ready. He moved with fluid ease and was unwinded. Zoltan, on the other hand, seemed to be tiring a bit. He was panting and moving his legs as if they were heavy. Interesting. Gord stepped up the pace with a flurry of feints, movements, and actual attacks, intermixed with much circling designed to keep Zoltan on the move. He was cut twice more in the process, but both wounds were merely scratches, although they must have appeared worse to the audience from the sound of their reactions to the touches. He now heard someone offer odds of a dozen to one. No cry of acceptance followed. Great. Now suddenly Zoltan carried the fight to him, stamping forward, his blade moving with blurring speed. Gord danced back, parrying wildly, saving himself barely, and taking a cut on his weapon hand in the process. Now his grip would be less sure, for the blood flowing into his palm would make the handle of his small knife slippery. It was certainly time for him to come up with a winning attack, or be beaten, and either shamed or killed. Zoltan was most certainly tired from his furious onslaught. His breathing was labored, and he was gulping air as often as he had the opportunity. When he eased his attack a bit, Gord again countered with his own series of cuts, rushes, and so on. He feigned exhaustion also, and gradually slackened the pace of his offense. The bigger man thought he saw his opportunity and went for it. Zoltan jumped forward suddenly, body crouched low, right arm looping forward, dagger set for a killing thrust into the kidneys or gut. But Gord wasn't there when the attack ended. He had suddenly leaped back as far as possible, pulling on the leather thong with all his might. Zoltan, off balance, continued forward and fell heavily on his face, his left arm extended by the tie, dagger likewise before him. In a flash, Gord leaped atop the man and looped the thong about his neck and poised his knife at the edge of his throat. "Who is the dog?" he asked. "Not my brother Gord," came the strangled reply from Zoltan. "I am yours then, Gord," cried the Rene girl Estrella, rushing to his side. Well, mostly this is, a description of combat. So it's an action description and filled with good ideas for a DM on how to describe combat, probably between two mid-level experienced fighters so that they have enough hit points. Gord absorbs, I think, four described wounds, as well as Zoltan. It being talked about how Zoltan is... losing his breath and seems more tired. So probably what we have is without any terrifically bad blows or critical hits, we have a good description of what a more drawn out fight would be. The weapons aren't particularly high damage. I wanted to mention that it's entirely possible that the weapon, the long dagger that Gord had thrown, was always described as being of great craftsmanship, but it also might have been a magic weapon. It's not described as something with any magical ability, but again, with the description of high craftsmanship and Gord's ability with that long dagger, I would imagine it could possibly be a low-level enchanted blade. Now, here we're given the opportunity to see that the Rene have a way out of these fights in a non-lethal manner, but that 12 silver nobles. Now, I'm not sure, they haven't given a definitive breakdown of silver to electrum or silver to gold, so I'm not quite sure how valuable silver is. It could be that we have silver as one of the lower value coins, and it, with it like silver, bronze, brass, copper, well, actually silver, copper, bronze and brass and iron as the lower values, and then electrum and electrum and
gold.
Gold and platinum being the higher level of coinage.
Yeah, I have a chart somewhere, but I'm not sure I want to post it because it hasn't really been revealed in the books yet.
I'd rather save that.
Yeah, we know.
Everything we've posted is going on.
Right.
We get these pictures like that picture of Gord at the beginning of the book by Clyde Caldwell, and we have the picture of the map of the area, which we can see now. The saga of Old City is actually about 100 pages, less than a third of the entire novel. And the area map is actually going to be very useful for the rest of the book as it describes more of Gord's adventures beyond the city.
Yeah, so now we know why that map was included.
Yeah, I also think that the City of Hawks map also shows that the City of Hawks map is a little different from whatever map sketch that Gygax was using for Saga of Old City.
Yeah, some of the things just don't line up.
Not entirely, not without some explanation. I mean,
still better than the box set, though.
Well, yes, and I think that whatever details that we see in the City of Hawks Greyhawk map, I think those details definitely they follow along the story, even this story, as the first one, much more, and you know, definitely much more than the much smaller and different shape and the different way the river works and such in the second edition City of Greyhawk box set.
Yeah.
Let's see where we are.
That gets annoying. I mean, the fact that the river only touches that tiny portion in the box set.
Yes, and it makes Old City that, and you know, for different shipping there, but the bulk of the city was removed from that for maybe various other reasons. You know, I believe that the low quarter, the river quarter, the strip, that all of them are much lower level if you had a contour map than the Old City itself up on the hill.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And so, you know, up on the hill, you would be able to be in the Old City and have your fortifications overlooking the Grey Run and whatever docks might have been there, and perhaps the Citadel as a separate fortress overlooking the Skeleton, and only, you know, the growth of the population. Because as we have mentioned in the earlier section about the Acorns, that tavern and inn where Gord and San were staying, that had existed before the wall that came down from Old City and now encompassed all of the new city.
It's kind of like it could have been. I'm just making an analog, but it sounds like maybe the Outs Inn in Yggdrasil, you know, an inn that's actually outside of the wall.
Yeah. I you know, I'm not very, I wish I didn't keep, it got so pricey, I never kept hold of my Yggdrasil, so I also wasn't really in love with that map, or it was a decent city, but it just, nothing in it really, it had a sense of Greyhawkness to it, but it still wasn't anything I was going to use for any particular cities in my campaign.
I thought it was interesting the way he sets up locations, but yeah, beyond that, the city wasn't like, wow, I got to run this.
Yeah.
It was nice. I mean, he wrote it, so I was interested.
Yeah, and it was structured. It was a nicely structured city. Like I had pointed out earlier, I think he missed entirely about what you would have to do about the guardsmen that you would need. He describes basically one group of guards who are going to be on duty 24/7, which makes no sense. Yeah, it's like how most of these places have a city watch and a night watch. There needed to at least be a group who were on part of the day. And if not, I really think at least three and maybe four different groups that watched in the same way at these gates. But jumping back to this right here, we also have this business with the gambling. So that this fight, I don't know how life or death it actually is among their own people.
Because, sounded like Zoltan was going for a killing blow, though.
And then, very easily, once he knew he was defeated, surrendered without any question. That once Gord got his knife to his throat, right. Zoltan, not my brother Gord, he immediately has no problem not fighting to the death.
Now, Zoltan has an advantage because he knows a lot more about the culture than Gord does. Gord doesn't know what he's supposed to do.
Exactly. And, we're at the end of the chapter right here, but Gord is Gord has stuck his nose into the culture. And I think we see, he quickly understands that he has maybe been, stepping a little forward into what he's not prepared for. All right, we still have about 10 minutes, so I'm going to jump into restart at chapter 11, page 102, paragraph 1. "What do you mean I can't give her back?" Gord said with surprise, but in a low voice. "I didn't want her in the first place." "It would be a mortal insult to Zoltan, Estrella, and the Rene Code," Yano told him. "Every hand would be turned against you if you did." "But I don't want Estrella." "Not that she isn't desirable," Gord hastened to add, casting a glance toward where his prize sat a few paces away. "Why can't I just make a present of her to Zoltan? I could say that I've taken a holy vow of celibacy, no women allowed." "Stop talking like an outsider, Brother Gord of the Rene. We have no such silly thing as celibacy among the true folk." Gord tried another tack. "Zoltan will be my enemy forever unless I return her to him." "Who?" Yanu sniffed. "He's your sworn enemy for life now, that much is true. It would be a good insult to cast Estrella back at him, but that would not soothe Zoltan, and it would bring everyone else down on your head as well." "Wait, I have it." "Have what?" Gord asked, finding it hard to keep the volume and tone of his voice under control. "The solution, stupid. You can solve the problem easily. Do you have silver? You'll need at least 50 silver pieces to do it." "Damn it, Yano, do what?" "Get rid of Estrella and let Zoltan know that you think he is worse than pig shit. All you have to do is kill her. The silver will pay off her family and..." At that, Gord was up and gone. He strode over to where Estrella was sitting, took her arm to help her up, and marched the beaming Rene girl off toward the barge of his family. This brought a cheer from the assemblage of onlookers, at least those who weren't too drunk by then. Gord resigned himself to his fate. He now had a woman whether he wanted one or not. Zoltan, meanwhile, stood in the background glaring daggers at both. Somehow, thought Gord, the fellow betrayed something more than hatred, however. Was that a hint of relief he saw in those sullen eyes? Break. All right, well, here we have exactly what we were saying, that Gord, again over a woman, has gotten himself involved, and it shows that for all his learning and experience, he still has a bit of a naivete, especially regarding women, that Gord is now, in his late teens, early 20s, and still, here he goes, and he's gotten himself, a mate, if not necessarily a wife. It also shows, the harshness of the Rene culture, where he's going to be allowed, to kill her.
All you got to do is kill her.
Yeah, and of course, 50 silver nobles. I'm just thinking that a silver can't be worth anywhere near as much as an Electrum Lucky. That just seems Rene, Rene don't seem to be rich enough to really be throwing around that. that heavy amount of coins, you know, casually. Of course, they may also have Gord kind of tagged as a bit of a sucker, and a rich one, so that they might be asking huge amounts, you know, like the amount to get out of the fight, the amount to pay off the girl. Those may be, you know, huge amounts of coin that they wouldn't really ask a member of their own tribe. But Gord, even though he's an adopted member, he still doesn't have the knowledge or the instincts of what it is to be a Rene. And obviously, he didn't know something very basic about how winning the fight wins the girl. Or that the Rene have no nonsense such as vows of celibacy. So, obviously, Gord, you know, there's a much different culture among the poor and even the high class of the city of Greyhawk as compared to Rene, as there should be. And it's nice that they do try to differentiate between the culture that Gord knows and what is a new culture that should be different. It is very kind of classical gypsy, but at the same, although this business of being able to, you know, kill Estrella and just pay off a blood debt on her, seems more Roman than it does gypsy.
Right.
All right. Well, it's a little early, but that I kind of takes us through, although it's the beginning of chapter 11, it kind of takes us through the general theme of what's been going on in the previous chapter. The fight, the business with Zoltan being angry with Zor, and because it's also supposed to cost him surrendering. It's supposed to cost Zoltan 12 silver nobles. But
does Gord get that, or
I don't know if he gets that, or whether it goes to his family and Miklos. Hmm. We'll probably, it might even be mentioned in further paragraphs.
Yeah, it'll probably tell us.
I am surprised that a number of things we've, either through memory or just where they naturally lead, that questions that I'd ask, or, you know, we'd both discuss previously, would be then answered within the next paragraph or two, you know.
Yeah.
So... But this has been a very good primer on the Rene. And I'd say it's much better than anything in the setting material that I've read that I'm familiar with. But I will eventually be going through more of the 2 and 3 Greyhawk setting material to refresh myself. I just don't remember the Rene being described in great detail, ever used in adventures, and ever really nothing more than just kind of like a slight bit of window dressing in the setting. But here, this is the second time that they are a main feature of the story. And here we're learning even more in depth about the character and the atmosphere and what kind of thing you might like to use to run a Rene campaign, or with Rene characters, or an adventure set among them. So, you know, again, this is one of the things that makes these Gord books so worthwhile, is that it brings the setting to life and it adds details that, living details that aren't really mentioned, I think, anywhere else.
Great stuff.
It is. All right. Now, we're hitting 7 o'clock and I've got to go. And so I've got to make this short. I'm going to end the recording for tonight. I want to mention that if you are following along, we now have the Greyhawk fiction text, and that is definitely where to come and see the maps and pictures we're discussing. The archives now contain recordings 1 through 12 up on the Cannon Fire website. So any of the previous recordings that have been made, you can go back and listen to them, and I believe download to listen at your leisure.
The channel's a great place to ask questions.
It is. And, you know, I hope that, you know, I'm very glad to see people listening. But if you have any questions, you don't mind being recorded. Or if you have any questions you want to put into the text Greyhawk fiction, please do so. And you know, we'll try to answer them and, you know, you if you don't want to be recorded, you can still be involved. We now have the Greyhawk Fiction Text Channel, so I hope people take advantage of it. Well, good night. This is the 20th anniversary of the Cannon Fire website. I hope people check it out. There's a huge 20 years worth of material up there, and much more than you see even on a casual glance. There's so many downloads and so much depth, and I hope everybody goes check it out. Well, until tomorrow night, good night, everyone.